Welcome back to Sci-Fi and Fantasy Read Along. I am ATN.
And I am Mule.
And I'm DM Phil.
What's up, guys? How are you?
Excited?
Yeah, I'm prepared this time as opposed to last time, which this episode
will be much better.
It's dedicated to Adam and Nathan. Thank you both for your support. That's right.
All right.
So, should we discuss anything about life and reality, or should we just get into it?
I enjoy this chapter a lot more than I think I did any of the others. The writing was better. I think the story was better. We could make parallels with real world, and I'm like, I'm really starting to see. Did you guys get it? It's not just prophetic; it's also historical.
Okay.
You mean like within the last 5 or 8 years?
Well, no, that's not exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking like the parallels between the fall of the Roman Empire and then the rise of Christianity and the influence Christianity had on the power structure of Europe.
And they say, right. There's another part in the very first section here where it seems like, you know, there's these young upstart.
The actionists.
They're not happy with the, no. You know, the preceding, the mayor, basically.
Yeah, they're his political rivals.
Yeah, yes.
And they, the new people who are younger are very discourteous. They're kind of like, you know, the old ways are dead, you know?
Resign or we're going to see you to the door, sir.
Oh, they are whiny, self-serving little punks that we can draw similarities with the people here. I think they call them something about like two millennia. I don't know, something like that.
I think they're always around is really what it is.
I think that's truth, too. I think that when we were young, we were those same little punk-ass kids.
Amen.
That the adults were like, good Lord.
Wait till these people grow up and realize that they have to be crushed before they understand anything.
Yeah, because those old people are laughing at us now. They're like, the tears of middle age. We love it. Welcome aboard, kids.
Yes. If anything, it's proof that things don't change. And you will always have young punks that think they know better than their elders.
And they do.
All right. Let's get started. In our last episode, the folks of Terminus faced and overcame their first crisis, all thanks to the efforts of Mayor Salvor Hardin.
We got also a message from Harry Seldon, like 50 years after his death or something like that?
To close out that section?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember what he said,
He
though.
Said basically, like, he planned this, you know, that the encyclopedia wasn't really the end-all, be-all of everything.
It was a fraud. Yeah, it was a fraud.
And it's all about these crises that are going to happen that are going to have to be solved in order for the future, you know, world,
good times,
universe.
The good times to continue
exactly.
Rolling. Yeah.
Exactly.
Part 3 begins with an excerpt from the Encyclopedia Galactica, which I always want to call the Battlestar Galactica, just because. But anyway, this entry is entitled The Four Kingdoms. We learn that the province of Anacreon has been reduced to several independent kingdoms, and they have had a strange society imposed upon them by Salvor Hardin, who we met in the last section, part 2, and who we continue with in this section, part 3. Chapter 1, in which Salvor Hardin argues with political rivals. So, as you said, Philip, 30 years have passed since the first crisis, and in that time, the province in which they are located has become completely isolated from the Galactic Empire. And we begin in Mayor Hardin's office.
Yeah, it's him and Johann Lee, right?
Yeah, his number one, his right-hand man, the coup master, as it were.
Yeah, so at the end of the last chapter, again, the coup was successful. Hardin is no longer just like this guy that they sometimes invite into council meetings. He is the council meeting.
Yeah, he's the mayor.
The encyclopedias are not important when it comes to ruling the foundation at all anymore.
Well, they're gone. They no longer exist.
The foundation's not gone.
No.
Well, there's people working.
I think Philip means the board of trustees has been dissolved.
Right, yeah, I'll agree with that. I just meant, yeah, some people die, obviously.
Yes.
It's going to happen.
Dies. Yeah.
Well, I imagine their enthusiasm waned once they realized everything they've been working toward was kind of a farce.
But it's not in a way because they continue. We all know that they continue their mission.
I'm sorry. The premise for doing it was a farce. The importance of it was overwhelming.
Apparently.
What I enjoy here is that we're going to get a meeting between...
A deputation.
of the new class of politicians and in the Foundation coming into this chapter, right?
Yes. Basically, this first chapter is a discussion of Pardon and some political rivals that basically is setting up the story for us for this part. That's all it is. They're called the Actionists, and they believe in direct action.
Oh, they're very threatening. I said it earlier, you know, they're not very considerate when it comes to people's feelings.
No, they're like idealists, and just like a lot of young idealists today, they're clueless and opinionated.
And dissatisfied as well. They think that Terminus is defenseless and vulnerable, and they want Hardin to step down, or they're going to kick him out of office at the next election. And then they try to storm out, and Hardin's like, whoa, 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 sit on down, young gentlemen.
You know, first off, he doesn't know exactly what these guys are all about, and so he has to really ask them. They're like just very angry, and you know, we're angry, and he wants to know like how they would go about doing something. You know,
they're angry and loud.
They are,
which does ring a lot of bells today.
I know, but it's interesting because he lets them talk and hang themselves on their own rope.
He does.
Yeah. Well, what do they want?
The Foundation is giving away science secrets to the four kingdoms that are out there.
It's like they have a money gun. You know those money guns for strip clubs?
Yeah, sure.
That's what the Foundation is doing.
They're helping give these kingdoms power, and then these kingdoms, they might actually turn their attention to the Foundation when they have everything, and then what are we going to get out of it other than, you know, pain and suffering?
But Hardin, it makes it clear that he works hard to maintain a balance of powers between the four kingdoms.
That was his success in the last part. He's explaining to us how he succeeded as a counter to what these young upstarts are demanding from him.
They're actionists, so they want war. They want to arm themselves. They want to attack Anacreon first or whatever kind of nonsense.
That blew my mind. They're like, you're making us weak. And he's like, well, what do you want instead? And he's like, we want to attack them. Like, are you kidding me?
But then he's like, who do you want to attack? There's four to choose from. Are you going to do it all at the same time? You know, he starts attacking their points of view and showing them that they might not be as, you know, equipped to do with what they want to do.
Your plan, it's not so much of a plan.
It's kind of stupid.
Kind of dumb.
It is good. Hardin really shines here, and as not only a leader, but also as a pacifist and really a manipulator of events. He really shines, and he just kind of...
He's a politician.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, not just a politician.
Tell me what his epigram is, because he has an epigram that's repeated throughout this part.
It's on a plaque behind him, hung up on the wall. It says, violence is the last refuge of the incompetent. And of course, Seth Cernath, what's his name?
Seth Cermak.
Seth
Horrible
Cermak,
name.
The guy who Hardin's arguing with, says that is just an old man's doctrine, Mr. Mayor.
But it worked very well for Hardin when he was a young man. Mm-hmm. That's his counter. And of course, he explains how he was successful, using the balance of power to keep the four kingdoms at bay, basically. And it's worked. It's been 30 years, and it's been working quite well. So in the process, though, like a religion has grown up around the Foundation, and the Foundation was kind of like, this is useful to us. So they have been using it and fostering it and funding it very, very heavily. So in a way, they've given their technology out to these four kingdoms, but they've withheld it as well in an authoritarian, top-down religious control structure.
So they're giving the power to be utilized.
Like literally a power plant.
And
like they'll give the technology.
Operate it, but not priests. Anybody that can do something about it any more than that, it seems.
Can't fix it. Can't modify it. It can basically not even control it in any way without training. And it's like, they're just pushing a button, man. Give me a break.
That's
it's
pretty
not
much
that
what
hard.
It sounds like they're doing. And not only that, and we're going to see this later, these people are down with the Foundation's philosophies.
They dig the free technology. It's made their lives better.
Right.
I don't know if you guys... Do you guys see the parallel between this and Dune? Where Muad'Dib said, he who can control a thing can destroy a thing.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
Exactly. And that's... I mean, this is...
We should do Dune. We should do Dune.
It's been done, but we could do it. Maybe somebody in comments will let us know if we're
We would have
interested.
Such a good time doing Dune. That book is amazing.
That's true.
I've got it in my room, ready to go.
All right. So Harden is interrupted during this meeting. Johan goes and gets a message from the hallway, comes back in, delivers this message. They have this coy little reading of the message, and then he dismisses these guys. He says, I'm not stepping down. I know what I'm doing. Later. Goodbye. And they end that little bit of conversation. And it turns out, in that message, the message that was delivered is basically letting them know that an ambassador, a guy named Polly Varasov, is returning to Terminus with news. And that is how the chapter ends. Is there anything in there in particular you guys would like to talk about, besides how stupid the actionists come across?
I just
sound so dumb. And not only dumb, but they completely fit his last refuge of the incompetent. You're just like, oh, these guys are incompetent.
For me, it's so frustrating to watch the actionist because they are literally just all full of passion and stupidity. And
you know what it made me think of is movies that I had seen where it's the communist meetings from the 40s and mm-hmm. 30s, people getting together and loudly discussing politics and the proletariat and the that kind of stuff. That's what it reminded me of.
I thought it was a little more like Idiocracy.
Yeah, I get that. I get that.
When you were saying that the doctrine that Harden has, about violence and incompetent, and then the Cermak says
terrible name.
It's hard to say for sure. It says that it's an old man's doctrine, and you rightly said that. Well, he wrote this, when he was younger. Harden did.
Yeah, he applied it at 30.
He was 2 years younger than Seth, who is sitting opposite him.
That is dang.
And it's wonderful. I mean, I like a lot of this interplay between these people because one person's looking really smart.
Yes, but when your opponent is weak, it does not make you look strong. It makes you just look a little bit stronger than weak.
We're in the podcast and YouTube phase of everybody having some sort of critique on something these days. Hello.
Meta.
When you're talking about something, there's always going to be elements of it you probably don't know if you weren't involved. And this guy here who wants to be a part of everything does not know about the inner workings that Harden does. And so is always going to be at a disadvantage in that regard.
Well, he lacks wisdom for sure. But it turns out he's pretty powerful in the council or committee or whatever the hell they run nowadays.
Well, and we're going to find out he's also astute because the other kingdoms, or at least some of them, are interested in taking over the Foundation.
Chapter 2, in which Salvor Harden is brought up to speed on the situation on Anacreon. This chapter is setting up the conflict for the second crisis, as we will find out. So it's Polly Varasov, another...
I like that name.
Terrible.
Sounds Russian. But before you get started, it starts off with yet another epigram or saying of his, and I kind of like this one a lot. It pays to be obvious, especially when you have a reputation for subtlety.
That's the definition of an epigram right there. All right, so Polly Varasov has returned to Terminus. He is at once the high priest of the Foundation to Anacreon, and he is also the ambassador to Anacreon for the Foundation. So in a sense, he's a spy, I think, is kind of the deal.
Well, he's definitely coming here in secret because he's not wearing his crimson robes.
Yes.
And was even able to fool somebody in his order, I guess.
Yeah.
They didn't know it was him.
Bent his ear.
Telling them all about the ministry and everything.
Yes. I mean, that's an interesting point when they're talking about the terminology. And it's like the extreme technical term. He's like, I hope you didn't use those terms. He's like, no. We weren't talking. We were talking about the holy food.
I know.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
It was funny. It was really, really funny because I was thinking about it at the time. I was like, a religion built on that kind of terminology will never work.
Oh, it was radioactive synthetics.
Yes. That's right.
The priest was coming to Terminus to take a class in radioactive synthetics for the purposes of cancer treatment. I'm like, when did they start using radiation treatment? And I had to go look it up. The first time it ever was used to treat cancer was 1899.
Wow.
Right?
That's really long. Yeah, that's a long time
ago. Unfortunately, it was only much later that they learned that radiation also,
yes,
also
hurts you.
Causes cancer.
Yes. Polly Varasov goes to some effort to be unobserved, essentially. He just wants to be a normal guy. He doesn't want to be spotted on the planet. And he just burns some time waiting for a meeting with Harden.
Well, he writes his own essays that he never publishes.
Yeah, dares not publish them, right?
Yeah.
Dares not.
Well, I think it was fascinating. They did go over a little bit, and what I got out of this guy, Verisov?
Yeah.
Verisov, is that famous quote that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Now, Arthur C. Clarke said that, but, I mean, it was saying the same thing here, is that that's how they're pulling it over, because they don't comprehend, the barbarians on the outer planets don't comprehend how these things work, and it's been completely spun as gifts from the gods, or holy relics, or artifacts.
Gifts from the Foundation.
Right, which is the conduit of the galactic spirit. See?
It is interesting. It is, and by the way, I would like to point out, if those of you who have listened to the second episode, you will probably recall that I balked when Philip was like, he's creating a religion. I'm like, no chance. I was wrong. He seems to be creating a religion.
Look, the reality is a stupid person is going to look at something that's technologically advanced. And if they have no frame of reference of what it is, it's magic or religion.
Clark Tech, as it is called in the vernacular.
I might be able to look inside a car and understand things about it, but then there's
engine.
Exactly. I understand that these parts have to move in order to make it happen. But when you don't see those parts and things are still doing things, it's that's magic to me.
Jeez. That's a lot of things in the world, There's a box around it, and I don't look any further than the box around it. And I'm grateful for that, because I think that's a lot of knowledge I don't want.
Well, he also said in his treatise, Verisov said in his treatise, that science had already lost, I guess, favor or impact or belief with the masses way before the collapse of the empire, so they had to reinvent it.
Didn't he say that it had failed them?
Yes, for all intents and purposes, science had failed, I guess, humanity.
Yeah.
They had to reinvent it.
And they've done so very rapidly. Okay, so let's get to the meeting that he has with Hardin, because he actually has come to deliver a warning that on Anacreon, there's a regent who is ruling until the king comes of age in a couple of days. His name is Weenus. And that doesn't rhyme with anything I can think of.
But it's appropriate.
He's a dirty player, as he is described, and he is eager to attack the Foundation. He's rabid to do so.
And not only that, but he really likes being in charge. He has his younger nephew who's going to become king.
The king.
Leopold.
Yep, Leopold I.
He's going to be 16 years old or something like that. And his father just recently died in a hunting accident.
Whoopsie. Yeah, I can see where this is going, but we don't get to meet the regent, Weenus, for a little while yet.
Right.
But oh my goodness, the guy just sounds like a... Anyway.
Yeah, and not only that, but they... this is where we find out about the battle cruiser, I guess, that's being...
Yes, the Anacreons had discovered a derelict battle cruiser that had been, derelict for 300 years or so, and they're like, fix it for us, we want it.
It's awesome. It's like... It's going to double their naval fleet. And they got a good one.
Yeah, I said its storage capacity alone was half again larger than the entire fleet of Anacreon.
And it's in really good shape. And it's not going to take much to fix it up.
It's got big old cannons on it and stuff.
Yes. And Hardin's like, go ahead, fix it up. Rename it Weenus for them as a sign of our affection.
I busted your chops about that before, but it seems really clear now.
It's hard not to laugh at it. I don't care. It doesn't bother me.
When you are trying to create a religion
around penises,
you have to be able to
force your
way into people's hearts and minds, if you know what I mean.
Around rockets.
I'm sorry, it's like that sci-fi show Lex. You guys ever see that?
No, I haven't.
Yeah.
Lex ship? That's not what I'm thinking of.
Lex is a strange show, but I remember thinking it was pretty interesting, but I think it was pretty sexy too, wasn't it?
I think it was sexy.
Thinly disguised, not sexism, whatever you want to call it.
Eroticism. No?
It was close to erotica. I mean, there's definitely some stuff in there that was just kind of amazing to see on TV.
There we go. They went as far down the erotica road as they possibly could while still being PG.
I don't know who made that show, and I don't know what country it came out of, but it was not the United States, because we don't make shows like that, and I think that that's to our detriment. But anyway, let's move on.
Germany is when it was, where it was filmed, at least.
Deutschland?
Yeah, that's what it says. Yeah.
All right, so they're renaming the ship to the Venus. No, excuse me, just Venus. And Polly Varisov is like, it's going to be seen as a sign of weakness. And Hardin responds, trust in Selden. Okay, it's like, it's this trust. So he's not promoting science even among his own people. In some respect, he's just like, have faith, my child.
There's several parts in there where Hardin like smiles and he explains something, but Varisov doesn't get it. And then he smiles again later. He laughs because he was one step ahead, and you could tell his brain is turning, and then he's two steps ahead as he's making these directions to Varisov. Hardin's thinking, and it's clear that he is.
Yes, but he may be the only person that has like a lot of the information.
That's true.
Right? He's dealing with people who have no information.
That's true, but that's what I mean. Varisov came here, and it's clear to me that he has a crisis of faith.
Who, Varisov?
Yes.
He's worried. He's worried. He thinks that the Anacreon is going to attack the Foundation, and that would be sacrilege, but it would also just be bad.
But he can't see any way to avoid that. But Hardin convinces them, it's everything's going to be okay.
Okay, so last couple of things. Hardin says that the timing is a little bit off because too many people know about the plan, and he just told Varisov the plan. And he regrets it, but he had to do it to keep Varisov, you know, in the faith or whatnot.
Because, if I understand it correctly, you want to have as little people knowing about what is thought is going to happen, or else it might screw stuff up.
Yes. Their individual actions, once they know they're being observed, can throw off the statistics and the calculations, and they don't want to do that. They're trying not to do that, but the timing is off. There are two crises that are converging, and they're not lined up time-wise very well. So Hardin is trying to delay one of them in order to get them to line up again. And he says when the crisis is imminent, he will head to Anacreon himself.
And that's what that's what Harry Selden did, is once you comprehend which way things are going, you can make small modifications to have things play out precisely as you want them, when you want them.
And with hardly any training at all, this guy.
Well, no, he's a sociologist by training also.
Barely. Well, he said he got the basic foundation, and then he quit and became a politician.
Well, that's also true, but I think there's a reason why he came to power and why he can see these patterns and see these things. Not as clearly as Selden, but Selden, really, he just used mathematics and differential equations, and this guy just has his intuition.
And a limited amount of information.
And there are people that get by on intuition in situations where other people had to, like, you know, get out every single calculator they have during that time, or whatever it may be.
I do not dispute this. Salvor Hardin is good at what he does. He is the right man for the right time, and this is his time.
That's true.
He has a good application. He's able to apply what he knows and the situation he's in with whatever else he's got going on pretty well, it seems.
You know, if we go back to the last part, part two, I was just kind of under the impression that Hardin was kind of really self-serving and power-hungry. But in this one, my perception of him completely changed. And not only is he a devout believer in Harry Selden's plan, but, I mean, if you think about it, the foreknowledge that he has, the self-control he has had to put on himself to stay in the game, not let greed or ambition get the best of him, not let the power and the knowledge of the Foundation be put to his uses, but to be put towards the plan, and to keep it all to himself without having any confidants, other than Lee, I guess.
Other than those five people that he accidentally let it slip to.
I gained an enormous amount of respect for this guy who could not only keep the faith, but also maintain his focus and his self-control and his human failings in check.
Do you recall who the six people are that know the majority of the story?
I don't. I know Lee was one.
Johann Lee's one, and then the four ambassadors to the four kingdoms.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Did they say that?
Yes, at some point. I don't remember where it was, but
okay. So the ambassadors. Yes.
They're on the level, essentially, as close to as can be, that there is a plan and that they're on.
Yes, they're the high priests of each planet, right?
Yeah, the four kingdoms.
Yes, I was thinking the kings, but you said that
they're more than one planet. That's something that's been made clear in this section, is that when we're talking about a kingdom, we're not talking about a singular planet. Like, Anacreon has many, many planets, one of which is their capital, called Anacreon. All right, chapter 3, in which the motivations and ambitions of Prince Regent Weenus are revealed. So we are introduced here to King Leopold I. This is like a browbeating. That's what this is. This is a browbeating from an uncle telling you that you're dumb and you don't know anything and get your stuff together, kid. And that's basically the whole thing. It's just a browbeating.
At the same time, that kid, Leopold, knows that he is king in 2 days or whatever it is. And that he can have his uncle's head if he wants.
Yeah, he's counting the days.
But his uncle is trying to impart wisdom, like we just saw in previous chapters, into someone younger, but his effort is to destroy the foundation.
Yes. The entire chapter is basically convincing the future king that he wants to get rid of the foundation, just like the regent wants to get rid of the foundation. But I feel like it's a manipulation.
It is, because the kid is pretty much at first not understanding his point of view. He's like, these people give us this stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
why?
These people seem all right. And he's like, no, they're horrible. Look at all this stuff that they do, and they deal with all these other people. That ain't cool.
His uncle sees through it all on some level. He sees through it all. He does. He's not.
Yeah, he does.
He's not good at, I guess deception to the second and third or fourth levels, but he sees what's going on. And this king-to-be, is only 15 years old. Is that right?
Leopold, like, I don't know. He's going to be coronated in 2 weeks or something. Real soon.
Yeah, I think Leopold says, I think it said it was 15, and he's soon to be 16, which will be his coming of age ceremony. But he's this self-indulgent little adventure-seeking punk, which I completely relate to.
Yeah, sure.
And I think I was equally clueless.
Well, you still are.
He just wants to go out and shoot those
Nyack birds or something?
Yeah, that's what it is.
Nyack birds, but I hear they're considered flying fortresses, and they're pretty dangerous, and he's killed like 46 of them since he was 13. And he's like, I'm going to get 50 before
I'm crowned.
That's right.
Nobody's going to take that bet. All right, so the conversation between them. You said earlier that he was like, no, I thought they were good guys. I thought the Foundation were good guys. King Leopold does not want to attack the Foundation. He says that it might be blasphemy. And then, you know, he's educated on the fact that, no, it's mummery. That guy's been talking to you, Varisov. He doesn't believe in it either, no more than I do. And we really are going to have to remove the Foundation if we don't want anybody standing in our way.
Well, the uncle also points out that, well, if we don't take them over, one of our neighbors will, and then they'll have all that power.
It's obvious that he did not learn his lesson from 30 years ago that the Foundation is going to smack you down if you come at them.
Well, they're absolutely defenseless.
Yeah, I know. And they're fixing this huge ship. And I mean, it's 2 miles long, guys. The rocket that they're repairing for Anacreon, the Foundation is repairing this rocket. It is 2 miles long.
It's seriously like a superstar destroyer.
And as soon as they get it, Anacreon, they're going to turn right around and use it to attack Foundation.
Bang, bang. That's the plan. That's the plan.
I know.
And the Foundation is willing to do that. Harden seems really
naive.
What's he doing right there? Seriously. Yeah,
yeah. See, we question whether or not Harden has any. It's like, Harden, I don't get it. I'm like, how can...
Have faith.
Yes.
Have faith in Harry Seldon. He knew what he was doing.
But
that's like more than a lot of religions give their gods. I mean, there's always,
you know,
God helps those who help themselves. If someone's being stupid by running out in the street, it's like, well,
Darwin Award.
God ain't helping you on that one. Yeah, I guess all the guardian angels were asleep right then, you know.
God doesn't throw out miracles. All right, so by the end of this chapter, we have this moment that Ewell mentioned earlier where King Leopold, the to-be king, He's like, huh, my uncle. He's just, well, his uncle did just threaten him, by the way. He was like, be careful when you're out hunting and stuff. You don't want to have an accident. You don't want to make me angry. You want to do what you're told. And Leopold's like, huh, I should probably have him killed.
But he seemed like a naive kid, but now he's just like, as soon as I'm king, I'm...
Yes, but remember what Hardin's epigram is. You know, the violence is the last refuge of the incompetent. And this is where I understood what that meant, because I was kind of like going over it in my head. Like, the last refuge seems like it might be the first refuge, right? But I don't think so. I think what he's getting at is that it's like when cornered, and this is a perfect example. This kid feels cornered by his uncle. He's feeling threatened, and he's going to turn to violence to solve his problem. So this kid is incompetent, and he's to be the king of Anacreon.
I can only hope that whoever takes over for Hardin is not as bad as Seth. You know?
Cermak is exactly like the regent.
And he could very well be the next in line. You know.
Yes.
There's one thing in here when they're having this discussion. Leopold says, by Selden, if I had been my grandfather, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh my gosh. Yes. Now Selden himself is becoming what, like a saint or a prophet?
Mythologized.
A prophet.
For sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's, I mean, I wrote, I don't remember what the note specifically said, but I wrote a note in there and I was like, he's a believer. You know, it's like he's not thought about it deeply, or he wouldn't believe it like his uncle, the regent. But this kid has kind of like, but it's blasphemy. Yeah, I noticed the same moment. It was a very good moment for me. I really enjoyed seeing that because it transmitted a lot of information with just one word. Right.
And and the truth is, you're not going to be able to take out that upbringing from him. He's been brought up in the faith. And
obviously his daddy, his grandfather was the one that sent the delegation to go and put the base on Terminus
and succeeded.
Right. And then, but then immediately got kicked off within like 4 weeks.
Yep.
So his nose got rubbed in it. So he wouldn't have liked the foundation. So why did this kid get an upbringing in the foundation?
Because the foundation is supplying the nuclear energy and whatever that these kingdoms need. And
it
if
seems
this
kid, like his dad and the regent both would have hated the foundation.
Yeah, but you know what? When you want to watch TV, you'll pay that power bill sometimes.
I guess.
And not only that, but maybe if you're like not so into parenting, you know, you give your king-to-be to the people right. that are in the know, I guess.
Raise my child, slave.
Exactly. Well, he's getting a better education from Varysoff, it sounds like.
Yes, it does sound like the spy / ambassador / high priest has this kid's ear. Or this kid, what? Well, one way or the other, I don't know.
Yeah.
All right, are we good to move to chapter 4?
Hold on. I said the Ten Commandments. I don't know what I meant by that.
Oh, I don't disagree.
Basically, this is almost, they use the Bible as a template to create this religion, and there's all these things in it, like on page 109. I mean, all this talk about Prophet Harry Seldon and how he appointed the foundation to carry on his commandments, and there would someday be a return to the galactic paradise, a.k.a. Eden.
Oh, yeah, sure, definitely that.
To me, the biblical correlation was there. At some point in time, we had paradise, we got kicked out of it, now we're all suffering, and now the foundation is going to come and lead us back to paradise.
Chapter 4, in which the actionists meet to hear themselves speak. So in attendance, you have Cermak, Seth Cermak, but also one gentleman named Lewis Bort, yet another horrendous name, thank you, Mr. Asimov, who is recently back from Anacreon. He had been doing recon.
Bort shows up, and he's trying to explain to the other activists, what, activists?
Actionists.
Yes, same thing in this case. But he's trying to explain to them how they're sunk, how their plan's not going to work, how they're already defeated. Because
hey, what was their plan? Explain that to me, because it just blew my mind how dumb it was.
Their plan was to take, like, whatever, launch a coup and overcome Harry Seldon.
A puppet government. They were going to install a puppet government. Like, how easy do they think that is?
I have no idea.
They've got nobody on the ground in Anacreon. They sent this guy to go do recon, and they're like, yeah, see if you can get a puppet installed while you're there. Like, nah, guys, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it.
And essentially, Hardin / the Foundation, their network is so thoroughly and completely integrated across hundreds of planets, at least, right?
30 years. That's all the time that they have had. I mean, you cry shenanigans, I cry shenanigans. There's no way that in 30 years they have gotten that kind of control over technology.
I don't know. I can't argue with that one way or other. It did seem like there should be enough gray hairs out there to remember the old times that they wouldn't go for this stuff. But, I mean, new religions and new beliefs and public perception changes very quickly.
I mean, just think about 30 years.
Yeah, I don't know, ATN. It's kind of like a stand kind of situation occurred and, like, a lot of people died. Who would know how to deal with, you know, just sanitation alone? Something that you take for granted.
But they're not dying. They just fell back on coal.
Sorry, they don't even have coal anymore. That's what his uncle was talking about, where he said, it's like, I remember when we used to have coal to warm ourselves.
Because they're back on nuclear, dude.
Well, fair enough. Yeah. Okay, I guess perhaps it still exists. They
didn't fall further back than coal. I promise you that.
In previous chapters, anybody that was going to go back to using coal was considered, like, barbarians.
Yeah, sure.
So even if you can remember using coal, it's probably not something you look back on fondly.
Right.
And there were entire collapses of technologies in these worlds before the Foundation got involved again, right?
Yes. And the Foundation has been going around and bolstering those old technologies, repairing them where they can, but they are not, they're not everywhere. Like, they're trying, but they're spread really thin. But the point to take away, I think, from the recon that was done is that these people are devoted to the Foundation's religion. Devoted.
Well, okay, they are, but we actually don't have a full understanding of how far society and civilization fell before the Foundation came in.
I don't know. Like, using coal for power is like steam age stuff. So maybe they've fallen back to the steam age. Not pre-industrial.
I mean, look how quickly Nazism took over Germany. I mean, that was 10, 15 years? 10 years, really.
Was that a technological thing?
No, but it is a society's belief thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but this religion is authoritarian, but it's not like... Maybe it is. Maybe it's just like, you abide by these rules or else. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's really bad. Maybe it's
authoritarian. I think about it more like when a homeless person maybe goes and gets food from the church, but has to listen to a sermon first.
Yeah, it's like going to dinner at my mom's house.
Very good. So if you're going to partake of these wonders in this, you know, in this wonderful age of power again, yeah, you're going to listen to a sermon.
All right, you fairly well convinced me. I mean, between the two of you, you fairly well convinced me that it could have happened in that amount of time.
Just to back it up within the book, I thought it was the way they did it is, I mean, they went to the leaders and they promised this technology. And so in return for that technology, that
bend your knee, essentially.
Essentially, this is what we're going to do. And the leaders were overwhelmingly for it. Because all they saw was the gain that they would get.
Right. Well, there's a really good metaphor that he gives later on. It's actually not a metaphor. I forget what it is, but he gives it to us later on.
It's a parable.
It's a parable. Thank you very much. But let's get to the parable later in its appropriate chapter. For right now, let's talk about the actionists and their perspective. They see Hardin as having strengthened their enemies and having Anacreon. They think Anacreon is ruled by an ambitious man and that they will be attacked by Anacreon very, very soon. And while they're having this discussion, somebody comes in with a copy of the journal, which is run by Salvor Hardin, I will point out. And it says that Hardin is heading to Anacreon. And so they're like, it is treason. It is treachery. So he's heading off and they're unhappy.
Yeah,
still.
They think that not only is he providing the tools for Anacreon to destroy the Foundation, but he's going to go back to Anacreon and get his money or whatever it may be.
Yes. It doesn't look good. It doesn't look good. And I think they say that they're going to try to impeach him.
They are while he's gone, I think.
Yeah. No, they do try. All right. You guys have anything else? It means that the second crisis is right now. It's happening.
Yes, exactly.
Because Hardin is on his way to Anacreon. He said that would be the trigger that would send him to Anacreon. And that seems to be what's going on. Chapter 5, in which Johan Lee escorts Salvor Hardin to the spaceport. I'm choosing to call it a spaceport, not an airport.
Very well. Go ahead.
Spaceport.
Okay.
So Salvor Hardin is on his way to the airport with bodyguards and Johan Lee. Spaceport, thank you. He's on his way to the Virgin Atlantic Spaceport, whatever it's called. The excuse for him going to Anacreon is King Leopold's coronation. But as we can probably infer, it's crisis number two, and he wants to be on the planet. Politically, things are getting really, really hot. The actionists have a lot of support. They had tried to get him impeached, and it had failed, but it had barely failed.
Oh, that's right.
You're they're right. Ready for action, whatever it is. They're about to act, as the name implies. And then they discuss the 80th anniversary of the Foundation, and maybe Selden's going to show up again, maybe not.
I don't know. This whole interchange they got, this is a very short chapter. It's like 2 pages.
Yeah, I know, and I've already gone on too long.
Yeah,
so.
I know. I had this impression of this whole interchange. It was kind of like Kirk and Spock, where Spock's like, oh, there's all these reasons, there's these dangers. Captain, have you figured this out? And then, of course, like...
Philip, I don't know if you understand how exactly correct you are.
Okay.
The purpose behind this literally was to just inform us of some things that Spock or... what's the other guy? It's like, I'm a doctor, not a...
Bones.
Bones, thank you. It's Spock or Bones or one of those people informing the captain. Got to tell us what the story is, man, and that's what he's doing right here.
It's a walk and talk scene for sure.
Yeah, and Hardin is like Kirk. He's just like cavalier and devil may care, and oh yeah, don't worry about that.
And Lee's a worrier, you know. He's got to worry.
Oh, you're right. He's like Dr. Yeah. McCoy more than Spock, that's for sure.
Bones. All right, so he's about to get on a space plane, a rocket. I don't know, not the weenus. And he tells Johan Lee to go back to the council today, let them know that he's leaving. So it's like we went back in time a day. I don't really know. And then let them know that the vault is going to open up on a specific day in the very near future. Selden's going to reappear, even though that's kind of like a maybe thing. He doesn't really know. And to let them know that it's to impart important information regarding the recently concluded crisis. Successfully concluded crisis. I'll have you add. I will add. That's so grammar of me. I need Grammarly desperately. Please give us money and support this podcast.
Wow. I just got that. Yeah.
I never heard that.
Advertising, got it.
All right. So the purpose of this message that he's having Johan relay is to delay. Remember, we were talking about delaying one of those timelines so the crises line up perfectly and there's only one option. That seems to be his purpose here. He just wants to delay them just a tiny little bit. And line up those crises. They arrive at the airport, spaceport, and that is that.
And he tells him that Harry Selden has a message, but there's no guarantee that that's the case.
No. No, there is not. He's lying, basically. He's bluffing. He's not lying.
Right. That was just to prove I actually read that part. March 14th, by the way.
He did read it, ladies and gentlemen.
Not only that, they're still using months that we use here.
Yes, that's great. I know. The calendar itself is ridiculous, but that's okay.
And there were actually, before we get on to the next one, there was in a previous chapter a mention of a woman.
That's right. I remember one being mentioned, but I don't remember in what capacity.
She gave the journal to Varisov when he was pretending to be normal.
So she sold him a journal?
Oh, no, it wasn't the journal. It was he was going to get...
The appointment.
Yeah,
he made the appointment. Yeah. He called to arrange the appointment, and it was a uninflected woman's voice. So as close to a robot as you could get. Huh? Barely a woman at all.
There'll be another.
There will be more, I hope, yes. Chapter 6, armed with information, Salvor Hardin arrives at the capital of Anacreon. So I am choosing to overlook the fact that he flew to all these different planets and gathered information before he showed up on the capital of Anacreon to have his little meeting with Varisov, which was very brief because of all the pageantry. The coronation is about to happen. Everybody's tied up in that. Absolutely nothing is going on that's not related to the pageantry. Hardin just kind of wants to slip into the crowd and go unnoticed. But eventually, the Prince Regent Weenus finds him, tracks him down, and says to him, please, come into my trap.
Well, yes, that's kind of what that's what he does. That's not what he said. But he chastised him.
He might as well have. Yes. Do you know what I mean? He might as well have. This guy is such a ding-dong.
There's this part where Hardin, pours himself a glass of wine a second time.
Yes.
He's like, I got one up on you.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, it's good. It's good. There's a lot of good back-forth play here in this thing. So I'm not sure why, but we are reminded once again of the vast scale of the local region that we're dealing with. I'm not really sure what that's about. But Hardin has flown there, agreed to be in his trap, has gone into this dude's office. There are armed guards preventing his departure. He's essentially a prisoner of war, but he's not allowed to make contact with his home planet, Terminus.
Yes, but nobody knows he's there. He kind of like snuck into the ball, kept a really low profile, and even when he was going up the stairs, arm in arm, it was a show, right? It was a show.
Yeah. Yeah.
But nobody knew who Hardin was.
Except that obviously Varisov knows that he's there, and this Weenus knows perfectly well who he is.
And Cermak knows also. And Bort.
Seth Cermak. Well, they know he went.
Well, yeah, that's true.
All right. So anyway, he's a prisoner, and old Hardin is like, yeah, sure. Well, if you're going to hold me prisoner, I just thought you should know that I planned my counterstroke for midnight, which is 5 minutes from now. So you might want to go and watch that happen. All of your priests are going to go on strike at midnight.
Well, it's even more than that. Weenus has his big old battle cruiser. He has his navy, and they're ready to strike the foundation, what, after midnight? Like a few minutes after?
It's noon tomorrow is what he says.
Oh, it was noon. Okay, yeah.
But they've already left.
But they're en route.
They left on his orders before the king became the king, which I personally would have waited until the king was king, and then you could at least blame him if it doesn't go well. Nevertheless, the Navy's on their way to destroy Terminus. He's like, no, you're not going to do that. We're going to go on strike right now. You shouldn't have messed with the foundation. Bro.
I know this whole chapter. The only thing I can think of, there's this interplay between like Hardin and this Weenus, whatever, the uncle, the regent.
Weenus.
Yes. When I was reading this, the only thing that came to mind was Kasparov. It's like every single move that the regent has made was anticipated and already and pre-countered.
And Deep Blue had already figured it out.
That's right. He already countered it. He countered it days, weeks, months ago. He already figured it all out. He already figured out how to play this guy and initiated all these plans.
Yeah. At every single step, this guy is just face-palmed by Hardin. So he runs off just before midnight because he wants to see the coronation, and he's kind of a little bit nervous about what Hardin has just told him about the counterstroke that was set to happen. And while he's out there, the king, Leopold, it's a nuclear-powered throne, is like flying through the air. He's radiating radiation off of him in this aura. It's intended to be like magical and like deific, right? And he's flying through the air and on his way to go and talk to the people from this high window when the lights go out, his aura disappears, and his chair crashes to the ground. Right? Because midnight stroke. Bing!
He lives, and everybody.
Of course he lives. Of course he lives. He just doesn't know what's going on.
He didn't get too high up yet.
But Weenus notes all this stuff. He sees it all. He's like, uh-oh. So he grabs the kid. He orders for flares, and then he starts heading back to his office. And he's like, what's going on? There are people already at the gates, banging on the gates and being like, release Hardin, release. Like that, no time has passed. They like straight up turned off the power and showed up at the gates demanding they release Hardin.
Sure, because Weenus thought he was bluffing this whole time, you know.
Outplayed.
Hardin's
sir.
Bluffing. He's all, well, I'll call your bluff, or I'll see your bluff.
He's not bluffing.
He wasn't not bluffing. I mean, all the power, like you said, went out.
He shut their planet down.
Oh, not just their planet.
All the planets of Anacreon.
Yes. Yes, to punish the sacrilege and the non-believers.
So they get back into the office, and the regent, Weenus, it's very hard to say with a straight face, demands that Hardin stop this nonsense, turn the power back on, and et cetera. And he's like, nah, I'm not going to do that. And he's like, well, you can't stop my fleet. And that's where we leave it.
Did you guys, on page 133, did you see like the parallels to World War II?
No, please explain.
He was actually, in the very beginning, he was quoting Winston Churchill. He said, it's been my philosophy of life that difficulties vanish when boldly faced, and I have never turned my back upon one yet. And that's almost exactly what Winston Churchill said when he was talking about the Germans during World War II. And remember, this is when Asimov was a young man, and he wasn't
writing this story.
Yes. And so that had to have been very impactful for him, I think, on some level.
So, Yule, do you remember a long time ago we had a discussion on your show about what an homage is? That is an homage.
Oh, no. To Winston Churchill?
Yes. It's not a line-by-line recreation of the entire story or scene. It's just literally the, you know, it's a nod. It's a, yep, there you go. That's a wise statement. It's funny that he put it into the mouth of a villain. But, I mean, I don't know if you guys noticed, but Weenus is pretty sharp. Like, the fact that he acts irrationally is his flaw, right? The fact that he sees clearly, there's no question about it, but his attitude is, like, way too aggressive.
Well, I think Varisov called him out as having an inferiority complex and overcompensating for it.
I mean, I have an inferiority complex, which I overcompensate for, and I don't try to attack people, right? This dude is aggressive. In addition to having an inferiority complex.
Well, if you were king or a regent, how would you act out on...
Okay, touche. I don't know. Maybe I would do exactly what... I think that it's too stupid, though. Like, he's behaving in a way that is stupid. He's not subtle. You know, like, the need to explain... The need to explain yourself as a villain, like, people make fun of that. It was made fun of in The Incredibles, you know? It's like, this guy just wants to be heard, you know? It's just like, let me explain myself to you. But it's like, no, you don't, like, I don't need the explanation to understand that this dude is, like, after blood and vengeance. I don't need that. So it's heavy-handed to me. He feels like a doofus. He doesn't feel like a real threat. And it's not helped by the fact that he is outmaneuvered at every step of the way.
Kasparov.
Like weeks beforehand. At least days beforehand.
Hardin had asked about the King Leopold and said, oh, we've heard he's very sick. I hope he gets better. Or something like that. Do you remember what I'm talking about? And when it...
Yeah, he was accusing the regent of having an in for the kid.
Maybe he's already being poisoned. I thought maybe it was radiation. They didn't really specify at all. But when he actually... When his throne came crashing down, he said he was wax-faced. And I don't know if that was because he was afraid, or is he actually in the process of dying?
No, I think shock, man.
Oh, okay.
I think he was in shock. Like, he believes his own hype, right? This kid thinks that he's actually, like, half a deity, and that the aura that's being produced is, like, him. He produces that aura. Remember, he's a believer. So his chair falls to the ground, and his aura disappears, and the lights go out, and all of a sudden, he's just a human again.
Okay.
So chapter 7, the head priest attendant upon the flagship Weenus is a fellow called Theo Apparat. He hadn't wanted to believe it. He hadn't wanted to believe what Varisov had told him, that his navy was en route to Terminus to wage unholy war on the Foundation itself. But it is.
So my understanding is that also precisely at midnight, did his ship go down too at that exact time, or did he make it go down?
He made it go down, but it was done by somebody's hand on the planet of Anacreon.
The hyperwave relay?
Yes. This guy had actually helped install the hyperwave relay. They had told him that it was such a holy device that it was only going on a ship most fit, the flagship Weenus. So he helped install it. He helped work on the ship. Like, he's, you know, whatever. He's a high priest. He's deep in it. And he's like, this is an unholy mission. I'm going to curse this ship. So he goes to the communications station. He gets on the TV and he curses the ship.
Oh, yes. Every single person on this 2 mile long ship is hearing him give this.
2 miles long.
It lets them know that they're going to commit a blasphemous act and their souls are forfeit, basically.
Yeah.
If you don't, if you go along with this. Exactly.
Yeah. Everybody's culpable. All right, so he curses the ship, and as soon as he's finished with his curse, and he curses everything, curses it all, and then the ship dies, just turns off.
Yes, like
completely dead.
Right when he finishes his final word, just the whole ship goes dark.
Well, he thinks to himself for just a moment that the chief characteristic of the religion of science is that it works. And I have to say that that is a dig. That is a huge dig at religion in general.
Well, Asimov was a devout atheist.
It's just funny, man. It's just funny. Like, He obviously fetishizes science in a way that is unhealthy.
Probably. But so this priest on this ship, the Winnis, pulls out...
Weenus, dude. Why can't you say that word?
I don't want to say
Why can't you say Weenus. It? The word is Weenus. He named the rocket Weenus. It rhymes with part of your anatomy. Just say it.
Weenus.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, fine. Whatever. I just, you know...
It's Weenus. No, it's not Weenus.
I tried to figure out any way to say it other than Weenus, but it's just too fun to say.
Perhaps it's as Venus?
No.
It's not a German word.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this priest pulls out this light, and he's the only one that's got light on the entire ship. And what do you think? That is more symbolic of a religion than I could possibly think of. Oh, come to the light. The light will guide you and everything else. And it does, because this priest is the only one who has it. And he's going through the halls of this two-mile-long ship. And everybody who sees him pass follows along behind him.
He is telling them that your souls are not yet lost. Follow me.
And they do.
Oh, yeah. Remember, this entire culture is devoted to the foundation. And so he just told them, you're all going to hell. Unless, well, no, you're all going to hell. This is an unholy mission. I curse thee, and the ship turns off. Like, you would be pretty convinced, too, I think, if there was a correlation like that. Nevertheless, they locate the admiral, who is the Prince Lufkin, who is the son of the regent, Weenus, and they seize him handily and a little roughly, I think.
He tries to get his people to turn on.
He says something real smart too. I don't have my book handy, but he says something about this religion is based on moonbeams, and it's hilarious.
Yeah, he said, it's like, do you cringe before a religion compounded of clouds and moonbeams?
Oh, it's so good. I mean, that's such a beautiful thing to say, and it's so true. But they do. They do cling to this religion. They do not listen to him. They do not shoot.
It's apparat.
Apparat, thank you. They do not shoot Apparat. And he's like, you imperil your souls by listening to this blasphemy. Seize him, and they do.
He does set up Lufkin to give a verbal announcement.
Yeah, he does.
You sit him in front of the televisor.
It's a hostage letter.
Yes, it is. It's a hostage letter. It's exactly right. Chapter 8, in which the crisis on Anacreon is concluded. So we're back in Weenus's office with Salvor Hardin, the five guards, and the king, Leopold. And they're watching the televisor in the dark. And there's Prince Lufkin, and he's all beat up, and his uniform is in tatters. And he's very stiltedly saying, the Navy will return to Anacreon immediately. We will stop all hostilities. We're really sorry. We didn't mean it. Arrest my father. He will be tried in ecclesiastical court. Or else we will bombard the capital city until we get our way.
Jesus, seriously, this is good. I love this. It's so good.
It was very satisfying to read. Do you know what I mean? Because like this, it's the attitude. It's when you see the attitude in real life, and people don't get punished for this kind of behavior. It just drives me crazy. And then to see this behavior being immediately and thoroughly punished, I love it. I absolutely
love
it.
That's true, but all the way up until now, like, you had no idea what Hardin's plan was, and you're just like, I'm on the edge of my seat, like, reading this, because I'm like, oh my God, it's doomed. Everything's doomed.
It's true. It's a lot like getting the reveal in a murder mystery, like an Agatha Christie mystery, something like that, you know, where it's like all these things are happening, you don't know what's going on, but this person confidently tells you, huh, tut, tut. And then later on, bam, they just drop it all on you and reveal how they figured it out.
The future looks bleak, and then just out of the blue, the savior comes, and it all makes sense.
Oh, so savior. Good choice of words there, because in this dark room, even though there's a televisor showing Lufkin, Hardin is now glowing. He's not glowing as much as the king had been, but it's subtly there, and everybody realizes
he's got this nimbus of holy light radiating from him.
Yes. And he tells them a fable. Anybody want to talk about that fable?
It's a horse and a wolf, right?
Enemies to the core.
The horse makes a deal with man to take care of the wolf, and they'll, you know, work together. But once that happens and the wolf is taken care of, the man won't take the horse, you know, he won't take the saddle or the spurs off the horse. And
yes,
that's
yes.
pretty much how.
Yeah. So who's who in this parable?
Well, let's see.
The four kingdoms or the horses?
I mean, in reality, it seems like the foundation is the man.
Not a very nice fella. I mean, he put the spurs to the horse in earnest. He's like, release you. Don't be stupid. I'm not going to release you.
Thing is that with Harden in control, it never felt like any of the other kingdoms. It doesn't feel like they're not threatened by him until he gets wind that he should worry about you threatening him or the foundation. And then that's when stuff, like he hooks you in deep, but it doesn't sound like these people are pissed because of taxes or anything like that. You know, it's just their own, I guess, hubris or desire for, kind of going along with that weenus/penis metaphor, just wanting to put that anywhere you can, you know, just invade and take over. And it's a sad
state. If they did not have that attitude, there would be no problem.
That's what I am saying. Yeah, definitely.
This is a storytelling trope, essentially. You know, your bad guy has to want to do something that nobody wants them to do, that is ethically incorrect or whatever, morally wrong, and your good guy has to thwart it.
I know, but the ease with which it was thwarted is just so beautiful.
Yes, because Harden outclasses these people. I mean, he's special in this region, definitely. But his enemies, again, are a little bit on the dim side. They don't seem that bright.
Well, yeah. Well, it seems like they only see, like, one thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and they go after it without any regard for self-preservation.
Well, Seth Cermak was right to worry about Anacreon.
Yes, yes.
But his solution
is to attack first.
Right. He's the hammer and everything's a nail, right? You know?
Yeah, like that video you like to show with the, this one goes in the square hole.
Exactly.
this one also goes in the square hole.
They can all go in the square hole.
So good.
Well, Harden has risen to the occasion and proven once again that he can solve all of these problems nonviolently.
He still has one slight problem, and that is that old Weenus is ordering his guards to shoot him with their nuclear blasts, as they are called, but they won't do it. So he goes and he wrests one of the guns away, and he shoots Harden himself, and the beam hits him. It just dissipates in the aura, goes to ground. So he turns the gun on himself.
Yes, another miracle, right?
See, that was the proper succession of events if you're going to do something like that. It's like, I'm going to exhaust every opportunity before turning it on myself.
Yeah, absolutely.
The last act of a desperate man, and he was desperate, was violence, and he used it on himself.
The last refuge.
Yes, and just the way it played down, where he was like literally shooting this disintegration ray at Harden and nothing happened. So in the eyes of everybody who saw it, it was a divine miracle.
He's helping Harden's cause all the way to his grave. It was a very satisfying chapter, I admit. I really did enjoy it. I really like to see Weenus get his in the end.
Sorry to those of you at home that are listening to this.
Yes.
We're
pun
still
unintended.
Just children.
Pun unintended.
Yes.
Good Lord, that snuck up on me. All right. Are you guys ready to move on to chapter 9?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And regain what level of maturity I still have left?
I'm leaving it here at the door. Chapter 9, in which Harden revels in his victory. So we're back on Terminus. The time vault is packed. People are waiting for the reappearance of Seldon, which is still just a rumor. But Harden is celebrated. He has absolute power right now. His popularity has never been higher.
He's at least got a 52% approval.
Well, we're informed by Johann Lee that the actionists, they apologized for their misguided approach earlier, but they've moved on to a new angle, and because they just have to be actionists. And they now demand that they annex the four kingdoms by force if necessary. It's just ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous.
It's sad, right? It's sad. Like, literally, when you do something dumb and somebody shows you, like, no, this is dumb. You should do it this way. And then they go right back to doing the same thing.
Yeah. They don't learn, man. They don't learn. That's, I mean, it's whatever. It doesn't matter. So Harry Seldon does appear again. He congratulates them. He says that the first crisis, they chose to use the balance of power, which was the only obvious choice. And that the second crisis, they use spiritual power to overcome temporal power, which, again, there was like a 98.4% chance of their success. So he figures they're actually there in the audience. But he provides them with a warning. He says that spiritual power is not sufficient to attack. So I think that is a indication of one of the upcoming crises, that they're going to actually have to go to war or attack somebody.
Well, he also reminds them that there's another foundation on the opposite side of the galaxy.
He does, yes. And along with that reminder is a measure of scale, that the periphery is falling apart still. It's kind of like a where we are now, a check mark. For the state of the galaxy. Well,
technically, the Empire's still there. It's just...
Oh, yeah. And very strong. Very strong. But incommunicado and shrinking. And very concerned with its own stuff, I assume. But we never mentioned it. Like, in the first episode, when we did, like, kind of the background for this novel, I don't think we mentioned that he had based a lot of the plot of this series on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbons.
Yes, I recall that.
So if you were familiar with that set of books or that history in general, a lot of the foundation should ring bells.
It does. And even if you're just a nominally knowledgeable of history, I think you can get it. I got it. I mean, it was to me, this was a clear...
It's like a parallel basically.
Yes, a parallel of...
He's using it as a guide.
The fall of the human empire. The fall...
Yes. Yes, that's correct.
Fall of the civilized world, the way religion takes, I don't know if they take advantage of it, but they certainly profited by it, that they inserted themselves into people's lives when all the world went dark, and then you had 1,000 years of the Dark Ages, and all they had was religion to guide them.
And disease. All right, so gentlemen, that wraps up this chapter. The Foundation has embarked on its first two crises. There are 920 years to go. Seems like no problem. They've got this in the bag. We're not going to be following Hardin or Johann Lee, is my guess. They said that they would be comfortably dead before they went on to another one or whatever, another crisis. So I think we're going to move on to a new set of characters in the next section, next part. So how'd you guys find it this time?
I liked this section.
Yeah, I did too. I enjoyed it immensely.
I thought it was kind of exciting, actually.
A little bit of action.
Well, it was. I mean, you know, it's definitely very Star Trek action.
Yeah.
Like, if nothing, one phaser shot and then a suicide and that's it. But there was a lot of manipulation and it was like reading a very exciting game of chess.
Sure.
Maybe check.
Absolutely. Hence all of Philip's references to the game between Kasparov and Deep Blue.
Mm-hmm. Or just Kasparov in general.
So I like to remind people that he lost. I mean, it's like we're all going down this path, right? There's not a job in the world that won't eventually be able to be replaced by computers. So don't get on an ivory tower anymore.
Oh, I'm not yet.
Just as long as there's always someone to fix a computer.
Those technicians that are basically like the Foundation high priests who are like, oh, I'm going to, I've learned how to do the holy food.
Yeah, or just like when you call your cable company.
Yeah.
Or
those,
you know,
guys
Apple.
Don't know anything. Those, I know, guys, but, well, don't know anything.
I'm just thinking like, you know, getting service from people.
Yeah. Oh, you get it's what you pay so for, great. Man. You do. You really do. In this life, you get what you pay for. So if you pull somebody off the street and you give them like the very basics of an education and you tell them to go fix people's cable, they're going to make some mistakes. They're not really going to know what they're doing. They're going to be going through the motions and maybe they'll fix your cable, but, you know, they might not.
Maybe they'll just scope out your house.
So one of the things that was in this chapter was they were talking about like the feeding mechanism for the Foundation. They take the best and the brightest from all of the worlds of the Four Kingdoms and they take the cream of that crop and they train them at the foundation where they're getting, it's like MIT for us, you know, something like that.
Right, but you know, these religious classes on technology are very specific. I mean, they're not. This isn't a tech school. It is a religious brainwashing school.
I think they're teaching them ritual.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I agree with Philip. It's like this hand is never going to wash the other hand.
They're never going to see it. There's an entire part of Terminus that is set aside for like special occasions for when people are like graduating and going back to their planet. You know, it's like it doesn't affect the people of Terminus. It just exists. It's part of the mummery that the regent had seen through. He's like, it's mummery. It is mummery. He's correct. He's absolutely right.
Well, that's why
people need something to do.
Well, that's why the Action Party was kind of completely in the dark and clueless on what was going on.
The Actionists.
So, because all of this has kind of been happening on the sidelines on Terminus, like the religious brainwashing, the religious tech school, and all this what have you, nobody on Terminus really has much interest in that. So they ignore it. And even when they see these pilgrims come to the city, they're just, you know, whatever, they're probably dressed differently, and just like in America, when somebody dresses differently, you don't talk to them.
It's like in those tourist countries where you're not allowed to mess with the tourists.
I think it's brilliant. I really like it, and it all came together during this last part, and it felt really good and satisfying.
Yeah, I agree. It was a lot of fun to read. All right, so do you guys have anything to add, or should we wind it down for this episode?
I'm a little sad that we're not going to see Hardin be awesome again.
Yeah, he was a smarty pants for two sections, two parts, part two and part three.
Yeah, I'm bummed.
All right, so I was doing a little thinking, and I figured out how we're going to proceed. We are going to do part four next time, and just part four, and it's real short, as if I'm not mistaken. And then part five, we're going to divide into a part A and a part B because it's like 80 pages long.
I'm with you. That's
and it's exactly 18 chapters, so we're going to do the first 9 chapters as part A, but we're going to call it part 5A and part 5B, so it lines up with the book.
Okay, that's good. I like that.
All right, that's what we're going to do. We're going to get back to reading. We're going to get to recording our next episode and releasing it to the wild. Thank you so much for joining us. Yeah, we'll see you in the next one, guys.
Laters.
Later.